This is Richard Verone. I'm continuing my interview with Ambassador Nguyen Phong. Today is February 18, 2003, about 9:25 a.m. Sir, we were talking last time about your re-education experience and going through some of what you did, some of the daily rituals, your relationships with some of the leaders, and some of the more humorous incidents that happened. You found yourself in a position of leadership amongst the men. At some point, you were able to talk with the camp leader a number of times and suggest different various projects to improve the camp. How did you feel in that position of leadership? Did that happen to you naturally, or kind of evolve naturally? And once you were there, how did you feel?
Well, I did not feel, you know, a sense of leadership. But we were there, mm-hmm. month after month, year after year. Mm-hmm. And since in the group meetings and the group discussions, mm-hmm. The ideas are put out to resolve our everyday problems in the camp, mm-hmm. and in our prison life. They seem to, be accepted by the other inmates. Each time that I was asked to give my ideas about various things, so I didn't feel like, playing leadership at all. And then it turned out that I became some kind of a source of fun and comfort to them, especially after it was a closing time by 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. The iron doors of the cell were closed. And then we sat down and talked.
In your barracks?
In our cell, the barrack.
Okay.
We were about 100 in each building.
You didn't have individual cells in the barracks?
No, we were all together, about 100. Double level.
Right.
And it turned out that in the evenings they like very much that I tell them stories, mainly how people behave in the West, mm-hmm. and things like that, since I was in France and in England and some. Mm-hmm. So I told them all kinds of stories about the kind of life that the French, British, mm-hmm. had there.
Do you remember any specifically, any of the stories that you told?
Oh yes, very much. I mean, first of all, they were very interested in the eating habits.
Okay.
So I try and point out the big difference between the British and the French in their eating habits, mm-hmm. and drinking habits too, mm-hmm. and the kind of food, completely different. British food, very dull, and then the French, they eat like mad. And they were very interested in that. And so for the food item, it also went into other countries. I talk about the friends I had in England from India. And so we used to cook lots of curries, all kind mm-hmm. of curries, goat curries, sheep curries, and beef curry, and prawn curries. And of course also pastries, mm-hmm. the Austrian pastries, mm-hmm. the Scandinavian pastries, and the French pastries.
Did they want to hear about the food because food
was
so scarce?
We're always so obsessed with food. There was nothing to eat.
Right.
And of course I brought out everything, the Spanish kind of paella, valenciana, mm-hmm. and then all the pastas of the Italian and the couscous of the North Africa area. And so that occupied us for many months.
Right.
And before and then after that, we went into courting. Boys and girls,
uh-huh.
In the West. And also celebrations for Christmas and New Year. So they were very interested in those things, and most of them, of course, did not have any opportunity to travel abroad. So,
right.
And then, of course, I invented a few tales for them when I ran out of true stories. But
what would you say? What kind of tales would you invent?
Well, I invented, for example, stories between boys and girls and mm-hmm. things like that, you know, mm-hmm. love affairs and things like that.
So you were an oral romance novelist.
Yes, that is the novels that I put out to them. Uh-huh. But that was a very interesting story also that I happened to run into. There was a father and a son mm-hmm. I knew in England. And of course the wife died for 7 years. And the father was dating a young lady who happened to have a sister too. But they were very interested in that story mm-hmm. because the father's son eventually married the two sisters. So that was, you know, unbelievable for a Vietnamese mind.
Right.
How would they call themselves? Because in Vietnamese traditions you must call, you know, by your family rank.
Right.
And so that would be very confusing to them. And we discussed for months, you know, that situation. And they try to imagine what would happen in Vietnam if you have such a case, you know, uh-huh. if you had such a case. And that kept them, you know, mm-hmm. going. Mm-hmm. But of course it was also a very sad state of affairs mm-hmm. because many of the older ones died quite quickly when we moved to the north because they did not have any experience at the cold. Even many of them were from deep south, you know, from the Cà Mau, Bạc Liêu area, did not even go to Đà Lạt, well, much, you know, cooler weather there. And so when the hard cold winter of North Vietnam came, for the first winter there in 1975, many of them just, you know, passed away. They couldn't hold, and we didn't have, you know, much clothing too, and nothing to eat, of course. Mm-hmm. They got skinnier, and then we tried to help those old guys by using whatever we could to keep them warm. And the only thing that we managed to find was pieces of cardboard, old newspapers, and we wrapped those things around them with strings, you know, to keep them warm. That was the only thing. I was able to bring along about 4 big towels, bath towels.
Yeah, we talked about that, and you were able to keep them warmer.
And it was, you know, vital. For me, because I cut them into gloves and socks and the kind of jacket, mm-hmm. you know, to keep myself warm there.
Would you talk to the guards and tell them, you know, hey, these old men are very cold. They're not in good health.
They were also concerned.
Really?
They were also concerned. They were not, you know, shall we say, they didn't give the impression that they didn't care. But they had the same problems too, because they hardly have, you know, warm clothes. They had
right.
their uniforms, and
right.
it was old. And, you know, they didn't have much clothing, you know, those guards. They had the uniforms, and that was what they had.
How cold?
And it was very difficult to have warm clothes in North Vietnam in general, even for the population mm-hmm. outside. Mm-hmm. See. That's what happened to me when I was on expedition to the to the village market of Hai Thai with the kitchen van, and I was given a cake by an old woman once. 7 months later, I met her again. Then that was winter, and I had the only woolen, you know, from England mm-hmm. at that time, and then I took it off and gave it to her. But that must be, you know, a fortune mm-hmm. in the north. They didn't have it in those days. Wow.
Do you want to take a break? Get some more? Okay. Why don't you continue?
So about the cold.
Yes, sir.
I think most of the older inmates could not you know, deal with that.
Mm-hmm. How cold?
And I remember it was 0 degrees C in the winter.
Okay.
And you know the barrack did not have any ceiling. Any windows at all?
No ceiling?
No ceiling. You see, just the roof. And it is it's completely they are open.
Okay.
Really. You can see the ties up there. And then there was a big iron door, but then the windows with the bars did not have any, glass window or wooden windows. And so the coaches came in. I mean, you sleep there as if you were, sleeping in the open sky. And I remember the case of one of the older inmates there. He was the chief of police, I think, of Sop Chang City, deep south in the Mekong Delta, very near my birthplace of Bac Liu. He was chief of police, and he must be nearly 60 by that time.
Mm-hmm.
Very skinny guy, and that was probably in the second year. I participated at that time to make what we call the tombstones, pieces of rock that we polish, and then we just engrave on a number, because those tombstones used for the deceased inmates, we were not allowed to put names. Just put that number on.
Why not names?
I don't know. That was a regulation.
Hmm.
So we had an area there, a kind of cemetery, for the inmates to be buried when they die. And you have those rows of tombstones with numbers.
How many died while you were there, would you estimate?
Well, we were about 1,200 or 1,500 at times. And I work out the figures also to see whether it was very abnormal or not, because we didn't have any medical care and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the figure that I came up was about 5% a year.
5% a year?
5% a year. So that was not too bad.
No.
Because there were other camps.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, that percentage was very, very high.
Did you guys hear about those other camps while you were there?
Not at the beginning, but later on, because there were movements of those inmates.
Mm-hmm.
So other inmates came from other camps, and mm-hmm. some of our inmates of our camp went to the other camp. They moved them around for unknown reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So we began in the second, third year to have those movements, and we began to get news from other people.
What did you hear about the other camps?
Much harder conditions. Much harder. I think the A15 that we were in, that camp, was from the number one camp, the nearest of Hanoi. And it was also a showcase, you know, for international organizations to visit and so on and so forth. So they made a special effort.
Mm-hmm.
And we were put there probably because we were also the creme de la creme, and you know. But the other, and especially the military camps, were much harder. So that one was a little bit more political,
right?
And also it was used for the USPOW, you know, before.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Hatay, just not very far from Hanoi. But that chap, he went by, you know, where the tombstones were being made, and he asked us, what are they, you know, with the tombstones? And he sat down and he cried, you see. And then a few days later, he went to me. He said, Fong, I need 2 dongs. At that time, you know, the salary of mid-level civil servant would be 50 dongs.
50
by all. And the guards received about 70 dongs a month after deduction of their uniform and food and everything.
Mm.
And that chap asked me for 2 dongs. He asked me to buy his toothpaste for 2 dongs. I said, come on, you know. why do you want to sell me a toothpaste? Because we were given each quarter a tube of toothpaste. And he said, because I need two dogs. I said, why do you need two dogs? You know? He said, well, to buy cakes.
Cakes.
Yeah. Bake cakes. Okay. You know, the North Vietnamese. It's very hard, but it looks like a moon cake, as you know, small one, but it's very hard. Anyway, kind of a biscuit, if you call it, what you call it. And I said to him, well, if you need two dongs, you know, I give you two dongs. You don't have to sell me your toothpaste. So I gave him the two dongs. And then he managed through the gas to buy some cakes from the villagers. And then he cut in small pieces and he went around in our cell and he invited people to eat his piece of cake for no reason. He had that feast with him. And then a few days later he died. We buried him. He was too weak to because of the cold.
Did he know he was going to die? Do you think he really
I at that time, I had the impression that he knew that he was really, you know, he couldn't hold it anymore.
Right.
Couldn't hold it. Probably that he didn't want to fight and remain alive and let himself go too.
Right.
Because in the following days, I noticed that during the night he was so cold that instead of lying on his bunk, he went into a corner of the cell and sat there, you know, crouching there several nights like that. And then he died in a very striking way. It was early in the morning because we were, you know, waking time is about 5 a.m. in the morning. And that morning, he got up from his bunk and he sat on the edge of the bunk and just sat there, you know. And we were all, you know, very busy getting ready to go to work. We start the day. And he just sat there and died sitting there.
Really?
You know. And then when the others, you know, around him came and then touched him, he just fell back. And we discovered that he was dead. That's how he died. Died sitting. You know,
interesting.
Waking up in the morning.
How did everyone react to that?
Well, we became used to it. So we try not to show too much emotion because I think I had the impression that you know, with those older guys going one after another, we also wanted that if it happened to us, we would not like to have the others to weep or to cry or you know, to manifest anything too much. But it was rather the impression I have, the attitude that we adopted, that when things like that happen in those circumstances, you just take them, you know, that's it. Don't show too much emotion.
How did you feel about your own personal health? Did you feel physical?
Oh, I
like
didn't. I didn't worry at all about my personal health. That was a funny thing, you know, because I brought myself to accept that whatever may happen. The worst, so I was all right with myself in that aspect. I didn't worry much, and luckily I didn't get ill, and I seldom get ill anyway. So, and that was not the worry. I worried a lot about my parents and the family at home, but I didn't worry much what would, you know, happen to us there. Because I considered that, you know, maybe the worst is to come, so I didn't worry much. But there was lots of very moving scenes, you know, from others that I noticed. There was a guy who was very religious, and he practiced our traditions and customs, you know, to the best of his abilities, even in jail, in prison. And when it came to the what we call the death anniversaries that we celebrate, you know, one of the major traditions and customs of the Vietnamese people, we must have a small ceremony to commemorate, you know, the ancestors of our parents. And I noticed that, you know, year after year in prison with him, he always tried to practice that and celebrate those events for his ancestors and relatives and so on. Mm-hmm. And he would go into a corner of the prison courtyard and try to set up a kind of an ancestor's altar there with the rocks and bricks, you know. And somehow he managed, through the guards probably, to get the incense sticks, you know, to burn. And since we did not have much to eat except that dough, you know, the steamed bread that they gave us, about 150 grams a day. But he used that to make the offering, you know, to celebrate the death anniversaries of his relatives, ancestors and parents. And it was heartbreaking, you know, to see the guy trying to go through the motion of that. While I also remember the death anniversaries of my ancestors, but I do it in my head, you know, considering that the circumstances, I used to say to myself, well, today is the death anniversary of my grandfather on the mother side, and then I would sit that a few minutes and remember him. That would be in my head only. But that chap, he was, what was he? He was a kind of a lieutenant, and he was assigned after the military training. He graduated from the Thủ Đức Reserve Officers Training Academy, and because of the draft. And then he was a kind of a brilliant mind, and he was assigned to the Central Intelligence Office, that is the Saigon CIA. And he worked there, you know, in the planning section or something. Very good guy.
How did that ceremony? Go ahead.
Yeah, and then you know, he would do those things, and not for the show of it, but he tried to do it, you know, whenever he felt like it.
How did that ceremony affect everybody else in the camp when they would see this go on?
I think that they were also moved by that case, that chap. And of course, we all had that traditional custom, you know, very deep down in our hearts. But there was no way for us to do anything in those conditions. But really, we thought that the guy tried, really hard, really hard.
How much were you able to continue practicing individual customs and traditions inside the camp? Was it limited or not?
There was no ban whatsoever. Okay. So we had Buddhists, we had Catholics, we had Protestants, we had all kinds of religions in there. But the inmates were also careful not to display too much of those things. But we had the feeling that you know, you you have those people trying to stick to their faith, and there was no no limitations, no opposition by the guards at all.
So there was no ban on any religious ceremony as long as it was kept quiet.
Yeah, quiet, and the inmates were very quiet about that too.
Okay.
That is to say, you would not gather together and do those things, because we knew that that wouldn't be tolerated.
Right.
Preach.
Right.
Yeah. But we were able to, you know, remain rather free to in our faith.
What about services to commemorate those deaths, funerals or rites of passage? What did you do besides making the tombstone?
There was no nothing at all in the prison itself. I mean, that would be taken care of by the guards, and we were only you know, a few of us were designated to carry the coffin. That's it. But there was no kind of ceremony whatsoever.
So what would happen? You would take the guards would come in and get the body?
Yeah, they would take the body just outside to their offices. They would put it in the coffin, and then they would designate a few of us to carry it, to bury it. That's it. There was no ceremony whatsoever.
Did they allow any contact with the family of that deceased person to let them know that the person
was told? And there was a very exceptional case. In fact, the first death, you know, which occurred in my camp, May 15, and in my cell too, was the case of Trần Văn Tuyên. And Trần Văn Tuyên was a very famous lawyer of the same caliber as Nguyễn Hữu Thọ, who was the president of the National Liberation Front. They were the same generation. And he was a lawyer from the north, moved down south in 54-55 after the Geneva Accords. And he became a very famous lawyer in Saigon. And he was known to have tried to defend the Viet Cong when they were brought to court, you know. And they, during the time of Ngo Đình Diệm, President Ngo Đình Diệm, they were just lost cases when you go to court and been accused of being a communist. It turned out a very unbelievable story, because Trần Văn Tuyên had an adopted son in Saigon. And we found out after his death that his own son, who remained in Hanoi, in North Vietnam, was the adopted son of General Giap. And that son came down to our camp to bury his father. And so Giap and Trần Văn Tuyên switched sons in Hanoi.
How did they do that?
Years ago, when they were, you know, the sons were kids. We didn't know that.
They switched sons?
Yeah.
Why would they do that?
One went to the south, the other one remained in the north. That is, that one of his sons would remain in the north. And I was told that Giap wanted one of his sons to go down south.
And so he gave one son to Giap to remain in the north, and he sent one south.
Yeah. And so that son of him, Giap adopted son, came to the camp to bury his father.
Were you able to talk with this person?
No, not at all. We were told of the story.
That everybody saw him come in?
Because he was in my cell.
Right.
And we were on a very, we had very good relations between him and me personally. Because he liked very much meaning to talk to me and so on and so forth. He was a very respected person. And one of the best intellectuals that we had in Saigon. He was very critical of the Ngo Đình Diệm, you know, the dictatorial regime. He did not think much of the Second Republic with Jerome's key and heel and so on, because there was a complete void in terms of leadership. And he was a bit in the opposition of, you know, the Winnipeg government during those years, late 60s and 70s. And so that was the case of Trần Văn Tuyên, who was the first man in our camp. Just 4 or 5 months after we moved up north.
That leads me to another question. What kind of relationships did you form with the men in your barracks and with whom you
very nice
every day?
Very nice. And I was very surprised that you know, almost everybody of very different walks of life, you know, they were able to get on with me quite easily, and they came to me and talked much more openly than you know, among themselves, because I was not in Saigon you know, from 68 to 75.
Right.
And so I was a bit, you know, remote from what happened in Saigon. And probably that allowed them to feel more at ease when they talked to me than with the people that they had to deal with every day in Saigon.
They realized who you were, what your position was, how high up in the government you had been.
As I said, when, you know, I arrived at the Lâm Thành, orphanage, mm-hmm. where we were about 3,000 there, I couldn't find even about 10 people that I met before.
Right.
You know, but everybody knew me and they were
right.
very nice to me.
Right.
You know, and even the members of the cabinet, I knew only two or three of them. There was a minister of public works. He was my kind of a childhood friend,
mm-hmm.
Because we, our parents were long-time friends. I knew the finance minister because he was in France at the same time with me for our schooling there. Just two or three that we that I knew well. And then I met a few of them, so all together about 10 people of the 3,000, of the Saigon government.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we moved to the north, I knew the less, because there were also people from the provinces coming.
Right.
And about those 1,200, 1,500 people, I knew just a few of them. In my cell, there was no one that I knew personally.
At age 15?
Yeah, age 15.
Did you form any really close friendships with any particular individuals?
No.
Was that on purpose, or did that just happen?
I don't know. My mental attitude was that it's not the place to have friendship,
Really?
And I had very good relations almost with everybody, including the guards.
Right.
And
right.
They were very nice to me, too. Yeah.
Were they nice to everyone else, or just to you?
They were correct with most of the inmates there,
mm-hmm.
but they were, unusually nice to me. They talked much more courteously to me.
Why?
And I don't know. And also, they seemed to seek, my advice when there was something, to decide the camp.
Really?
Yeah, because I got well with the prison director,
right?
Major Yu, and that probably influenced the other guards.
So they would come to you and ask you for advice on how to run certain things in the camp.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. What sort of things would they ask you? Do you remember?
Oh, there were lots of things. For example, how to group people. Team groups.
Mm-hmm.
Would that one, be better with that group and so on?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not to have too frictions between the inmates and things like that.
Okay. Anything else?
And for example, they say that would you, advise the other inmates how to wash their clothes after the day's labor, a day of labor, because many of them didn't bother very much to wash their clothes very often,
mm-hmm.
and so they wouldn't like to tell them, but they said, why don't you suggest them to wash more often their clothes and things mm-hmm. like that.
Uh-huh. would you wash every day, or had the option to wash clothes every day?
Oh yes, after a day's work, I always wash my clothes, and especially in the summer, it's so hot,
mm-hmm.
it's about 40 degrees C. And you take a kind of a shower and you wash your working clothes there.
In the lake?
By the pond.
By the pond. Right.
By the pond. And you wear them, and by the time you reach, your cell is completely dry.
So you would wash them on your body? Or you take them?
Sometimes, and sometimes you take them off too, when you need it, when you have to. Much mud on them, then
right.
you take them off. But if not, then you just try and get the sweat out of it.
But this is the pond again that had.
That's the pond.
Everything
comes from there. Everything comes from there.
Okay.
And then eventually, I built the water reservoir, with the cement and the brick
right.
we had later on.
Right. Right.
And then we put the filter system.
Mm-hmm.
And then we try and get the water up there to go down and fill the pump.
Mm-hmm.
So we began to have cleaner water
right.
to use.
And that was your suggestion?
I mean, yes, that's and it's not that because they did not have the idea, but they did not have the means to do it. They couldn't find the means to do
they
it.
They did, but you found the means for them.
And then, you see, when I was very well known in the masonry work, because I was the one who was able to, how do you call it, to line and shine the cement in such a way that you can hold the water. You know, if you apply, it's very hard, a thin layer of pure cement. See, it is almost a kind of coating that you put on the concrete
On the outside.
Yes, to hold the water, you know, of the reservoir.
Right.
And you have to apply it very hard and make it so hard that it can almost be shiny, you know. And I developed that technique, you know. And the prison head there said, well, only you can do this. So you should try and do the whole reservoir so that the water can be kept in there. Because if not, then the concrete could hold, but it would suck, you know, the water. It's porous.
Right.
So the Vietnamese term that they use is jalang, that is to say, make it shiny.
So Major Young, he was must have been very happy with you, and the fact that you were
really cooperating. Oh yeah, he liked very much to talk to me. Right. You know, each time that there was an opportunity, he would like, and he asked me, you know, ideas about how to make gardens, put flower beds here and there, because he received instruction to make it beautiful and so on. And that's why eventually, probably, he passed the word to that general responsible for all the prisons, you know. And then he came, because he was an amateur for orchids, and he told me that he had hundreds of flower pots that he collected here and there, and he heard that I was making flower pots, and he came to discuss with me how he could have, you know, the new kind of flower pots for his gardens. And then very often on Sundays they would come from Hanoi and spend the Sunday with me there.
To the other
and that impressed very much Major Young, because to have a general coming to the camp, you know.
To see you.
Yeah.
Was there any resentment from the other prisoners about that?
Not at all. Not at all. Because they were happy, you know, that I managed to have contact with someone, and we all thought that if ever we need some help, then we have someone to talk to. You know?
Were you able
that
to
was a plus. That was a plus.
Were you able to talk to him about other things besides the pottery? Could you ask about what was going on in Hanoi, what was going on in Vietnam, the world?
No, I was very careful not to ask anything of that sort.
Okay.
And I just left to him to bring up the topics for conversation.
Did he?
Yes. No. And that what happened, and at the beginning of December 1979, he hinted that I, you know, might be released soon. But he did say that he asked me the questions, Fong, what would you do when you know you're released? Would you continue to remain in Vietnam, or would you go to France, and so on? So he hinted several times like that. I didn't understand at the beginning. I thought it was just casual conversation. But then, you know, after two or three weeks, I was informed that I would be released. I was among the early releases.
Right. You told him that I would stay in Vietnam, take care of my parents, right?
No, I didn't say that. I said, well, you know, I was very careful.
Right.
He said that because I thought that he wanted to test me or something.
Right.
And so I said, well, it depends on what the government and the party would decide to do with me. That's what I said.
That's a good answer.
And I said I would do, you know, what would be permitted by the government and the party. That is the formula, the government and the party.
Right.
Anything.
Good answer. He liked that answer, I'm sure. Do you think they were worried that you would leave the country, go to France, and start an anti-Hanoi campaign or something of that sort?
Not at all. I don't think so. Because I didn't give that impression. And eventually after the release, when I returned to Saigon, I will tell you a very funny story then.
Okay, let's take a break. Okay, why don't you go ahead? You said you had a story to tell me about this.
Oh yes, I must tell you this story because it's very illustrative of the mentality that we had about the war and about, you know, families and relatives and so on.
Mm-hmm.
One day, I think in the second year, when they began to move the inmates from one camp to another,
mm-hmm.
and among the newly arrived, there was a very well-known lawyer by the name of Lawyer Sun, S-A-N-H.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very long-time friend of my parents, almost a member of the family. But he was also the associate of Lawyer Nguyen Hu Tha, who's the chairman of the National Liberation Front.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a law firm in Saigon, the two of them, and they were very prominent lawyers, very good lawyers, and they had that same law firm that they put up themselves, very well known even during the French period,
mm-hmm.
colonial period, and they were among the first Vietnamese lawyers to succeed, to become famous. And so that law firm of Lawyer Nguyen Hu Tha and Lawyer Sun became probably the most famous law firm in Saigon.
Okay.
And he also was in re-education, but I think in the Thanh Hoa camp, you know, even up north near to the Chinese border, through the channeling
mm-hmm.
of those rally points when just after the fall of Saigon. So he arrived there, and we were very happy to meet, being an old friend of my parents. But that what happened was that probably when they heard that he was moved to our camp A-15, very near Hanoi, Lawyer Nguyen Hu Tha, the former chairman of the National Liberation Front, sent an aide in a Mercedes, you know, a 2-hour camp with food for Lawyer Sun.
Really?
All kinds of things, you know. And we had a big feast, you know.
He shared with us.
He shared with everybody right away. Let's show you, see, that I think that it is true. In many Vietnamese families, we had people on both sides. I mentioned to you, you know, 18 of my relatives, uncles and so on, you know, together vouch for my release to be under the responsibility of their common custody,
mm-hmm.
you know. It was turned down by the government and
mm-hmm.
party.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the attitude that those relatives are very dear friends who were with the Vietnam Communist Party, you know. They did not have any, shall we say, hard feelings against us, the former Saigon regime officials. And in my personal case, I did not have any, you know, antagonism against my relatives on the other side. I think the conflict was too big for us to understand or to do anything,
mm-hmm.
and then we accepted, you know, the circumstances of that very prolonged armed conflict, which was also not only the fight for freedom and democracy between the communists and the capitalist worlds or blocs, but also it was a dispute between non-communists and communist Vietnamese. And for all kinds of reasons, people chose camps.
Yeah.
I doubt very much that the Vietnamese people in general, and even in my case, you know, that we really understood at that time what communism was, or what, you know, the free world was. You know. But we were caught in a kind of a conflict.
You understood, though, didn't you?
I grew up in the free world.
Right, you understood because of your education.
And so I continue to be in the free world, mm-hmm. but I did not sit down and try, you know, to measure, you know, what would be best for Vietnam hmm. or the Vietnamese people, whether we went communist or we went with the free world. I mean, it was a kind of our second nature that you continue to exist in the world that you were born in or you found them yourself in. You see, so after 54, there were half of the country, you know, in the south. And the other half in the north, but I doubt very much that the people in the countryside, particularly the peasants, knew why, you know, and we continue like that. You know?
You've said, I mean, you're saying that you did not sit down and try to figure out that whether communism would work better for Vietnam. You just accepted your lot. You were in the south, and so that's the side you represent.
It's not entirely to say that you accept your lot. But you found yourself in a certain way of life mm-hmm. that you were used to, mm-hmm. and that you believe in,
right.
of course. See, yeah. And then I thought in my mind at that time that communism was not good at all. You see, for all kinds of reasons. You know, through my education, through my upbringing in Europe, mm-hmm. I was anti-communist. But that was something very natural. I mean, it was not, so to say, a difficult choice. It was, you know, an internal, you know, dilemma. Mm-hmm. I accepted the kind of life that I was used to. Mm-hmm. That's all, you see. And so I'm sure that for those uncles and other relatives who found themselves, mm-hmm. you know, in the north, or who decided to go north mm-hmm. to join Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnamese forces to fight against French colonial rule, you see. And they did it for those reasons too, you know. And after 54, they found themselves on the other side. And they could not bring themselves to join the so-called Free South against the Communist North, you see. And I think that we were, on both sides, much more motivated by a sense of nationalism, rather the sense of, you know, ideological conflict.
Like, this is best for Vietnam, so I think the South, this way, my way of life in the South is better for Vietnamese.
Yes.
And in the North they're saying, my way of life is better for the Vietnamese nation.
And that was a great moment, I think, in the history of the Vietnam War. Because by the end of the 1940s, the traditional patriotic political parties like the Dai Viet and the Working Men, Kuomintang, mm-hmm. they realized very soon they were in a coalition government with Ho Chi Minh in 1945. See, when he proclaimed the independence of the country and the creation of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam in Hanoi. So, those people who were not communists and who were against the Vietnam Communist Party, they were very conscious of mm-hmm. that. But for the large majority of the people, mainly the rural population, mm-hmm. they didn't have any idea. And it was for them just to regain some kind of national dignity, national independence, and national sovereignty after 100 years of French colonial rule, you see. And that was what mattered to them, much more than, you know, communism or capitalism.
So was this a more of a war of elites? Of elites? The people who really understood the differences in ideology? Was it...
Oh, yes.
They were driving the conflict.
Oh,
the majority of the population was
yes. You see?
We just want a Vietnam.
Yes. And I think that in the final analysis, Ho Chi Minh was much cleverer, much more clever
right.
to play on those nationalistic, you know, feelings.
Right.
And then Ngo Dinh Diem and then his followers and his successors.
Right.
And of course, the Free South had an enormous handicap. in terms of context, timing, with the presence of the American troops and the American intervention, which was somehow perpetuation of foreign rule to the ordinary and common people in Japan.
It's almost like the Americans shot themselves in the foot.
Yeah. So that showed that, in fact, you know, inside a family, there was not much resentment, antagonism, or, you know, animosity. And we found ourselves in different camps, and we accepted, you know, and we continue with the ways of life that we were used to.
But isn't there antagonism? Isn't there some antagonism? I mean, I sensed it when I was in Hanoi 2 years ago, 3 years ago, living there. There was antagonism amongst the people toward the officials, the policemen, the people who drove in their Mercedes and BMWs, and the, versus the people who rode their bicycles. There was resentment. There was antagonism in the people.
So you find that anywhere, anytime.
True, I agree.
Totally. It's not because of the Vietnam War, you see? But in the Vietnam War context itself, I continue to have the impression that it was not much of an ideological, you know, conflict
it was
in the
so
minds of the people.
It was so ideological for the outside world, though.
Yes, it was. It
Cold
was.
War.
Yeah.
You know, communism versus capitalism.
Yeah. And I think that in the end, Ho Chi Minh was able, you know, to mobilize, you know, mm-hmm. those patriotic and nationalistic feelings mm-hmm. much more effectively. He wore, for example, the sandals. It's not that he didn't have shoes. See?
Right.
You never see him in a suit.
Right.
See? And things like that. And in the South then, we went Western. Completely. And it was, you know, very difficult for the common people, especially in rural areas, to see Ngô Đình Diêm in his white suits.
Right.
Everybody was in white suit. Even the U.S. ambassador had the white suit.
So Ho wore those things on purpose.
Oh yes.
And do you think there are any parallels between himself and Gandhi in that sense, that Gandhi dressed like the lower echelon people in India and wore the sandals?
In the sense that you know, they projected a public image was nearer to the mass. But I think in the case of Gandhi and Ho Chi Minh, there's an enormous difference.
That's, yeah, of course.
Because, you
course.
See, Gandhi was the non-violent line, and Ho Chi Minh, right at the beginning, in fact, he used terrorism.
Yes.
Because
yes.
he didn't have any other means of fighting, you see. And that is, I think, in my personal opinion, I think, the Vietnamese people, after the French, 100 years of French colonial rule, they found themselves in an impossible crisis of leadership. There was no one. You know, it's amazing that the Vietnamese were not able to produce a leader. You see. Was it because Ho Chi Minh, you know, monopolized the thing very early, and then also systematically eliminated physically anybody or anything against, you know, him? That we continue to have that crisis of leadership. The only attempt to provide some kind of leadership was President Diem, but he went astray completely, and he did not, you know, get the feelings and the sentiments of the population. You see, like Ho Chi Minh did,
mm-hmm.
and even now. We continue to suffer from that crisis of leadership. That is why it is such a chaotic situation. But I don't know when we will be able to produce a leader.
Do you think Diem was led astray, or do you think he was prone to go astray himself anyway?
Well, to begin with, he was a mandarin of the imperial court.
Mm-hmm.
So very much, you know, that type. And then second, profoundly Catholic, coming from a Catholic family,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the French influence and presence in Vietnam. And then he brought back, you know, especially from the United States, Western values. And then in his eagerness to modernize, you know, South Vietnam, he went completely Western and completely foreign, you know, to the population.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an impossible task also, is to deal with subversion, you see, and then the escalation of the war by Ho Chi Minh. Many people may think that the escalation was done by Johnson, you know, from Kennedy to Johnson, but I think that in the final analysis, the American intervention in Vietnam was basically a response to the action taken by Ho Chi Minh, you know, in order to overrun the whole country. He did it in different ways than the American, completely, you see. So the American responded in the traditional way of a big superpower, you see. Why, I think for the first time, I dare say for the first time in human history, that the notion of people's warfare was introduced in a systematic and organized way, not only subversion, you know, and kind of terrorism and so on, but a very clever combination of the political, diplomatic, military, and then conventional warfare with guerrilla warfare, and then using the population, you know, in the war as victims, also pressure, and also actors in that kind of conflict.
Do you think that, okay, if we go with what you're saying here, this argument that Ho Chi Minh drove the conflict and America reacted once after the Gulf of Tonkin incident, once the United States had become involved, say, by the summer of 1965, do you think that the United States drove the action after that, or do you think they continued to react?
Not at all. Because, you know, in responding mm-hmm. to the subversive actions and then gradually to conventional warfare by North Vietnam mm-hmm. with their regular units against Diem, and Diem didn't have a chance to meet all those forms of warfare, mm-hmm. you see. And the United States, probably, especially President Johnson, had the impression that he is in position of all the military might necessary, or power, you know, to dissuade North Vietnam, mm-hmm. not to try and overrun South Vietnam. And the main or the decisive moments, you know, in the Vietnam War was, first of all, when the Soviet Union had its bomb. And then, later, in the beginning of the 60s, the Chinese had its bomb. So these were the two, I would say, forces of dissuasion for the United States not to overthrow North Vietnam, Communist North Vietnam, but then limit itself in a kind of war which it had no chance whatsoever to deal with the kind of subversion, the kind of, you know, warfare that mm-hmm. Ho Chi Minh and Giap launched against South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So it didn't matter how much, you know, the military power you had, you were dealing with something which was completely different. You know, it was people's warfare.
Let me ask you about a parallel with today's situation with the United States and Iraq. If the United States invades and goes to war against Iraq, defeats Iraq militarily, and then occupies the country, do you see parallels between...
There are very clear parallels, because, you know, in that kind of enterprise, first of all, you try and use whatever you have as force of dissuasion or persuasion. And if you fail that, it's only then that you use your force of strike, you see. And after the force of strike, it's the war you have to occupy. So they have the force of occupation. But to do what? You see? And so in the case of Iraq right now, what would be your real objective? Is it really to put an end to sources of terrorist activities, you see? Well, it's not only that, but its main purpose would be to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. Maybe at the joy of all the other Arab leaders. Mm-hmm. But that, you see, that would be your concrete objective, is to put an end to a kind of a regime, see, a dictatorial and cruel regime. That is to remove Saddam Hussein. It's not only terrorism, because you think that he is the source of terrorism. Mm-hmm. You see, so you remove him. But the other form of terrorism will develop. And so they will say that for the moment, immediate objective would be to remove the man. You see? And so if that is your objective, you just do it very fast. You see? And then leave it to the people there to do what they want. It's not your business to tell them what kind of a regime. The only thing that you can claim is that the regime which is existing right now is evil. Mm-hmm. And you want it to go, disappear. Mm-hmm. But then, you see, if you say that you are going to rebuild the country and so on, like in Afghanistan, I think that you go into the same problem like Vietnam. That is to say, you begin to tell the people there what kind of a political regime they should have. Whether, even if it would be the best, the very best political regime in the world that you can invent, it's not theirs. They wouldn't accept it.
They don't have democratic traditions in Iraq, just like South Vietnam had no democratic traditions.
Yeah, because their concept of democracy is different. It's not that they are not democratic, but their form of democracy is something different. And in fact, you see, most of those people have very little interest in political principles, because their traditions and customs for thousands of years has always been the search for the virtuous leader. Mm-hmm. And they put their own trust in there. And in political theory, you have that loophole. You know, my own dumb George D. H. Cole asked me one day, he said, how can you explain and answer the situation when the whole people surrender, their freedom to a virtuous leader? And in modern times, you would ask yourself about Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore. The people there would accept restrictions or limitations in their personal liberties in order to, for the welfare of the whole country. Mm-hmm. You see?
You've talked a lot at length about the people of South Vietnam weren't concerned with a ballot box. They were concerned with having a bowl of rice and providing for their family and keeping their land and making sure things are okay. Do you think there's a similarity with the Iraqi people? They're not considered, they really aren't that concerned about the ballot box.
We have right now, at this very moment, in the year 2003, a very violent dispute and debate among the overseas non-communist Vietnamese. There are about 3 million of them now living scattered all over the world. One school of thought claimed that you must have democratic liberties in order to bring the country up, you see, mm-hmm. which is true mm-hmm. in many ways. I mean, for example, now you consider the economic and social organization of Vietnam right now, mm-hmm. What the United Nations and other foreign embassies in Hanoi try to do is that to promote free enterprise, mm-hmm. to have the free sector move up. And that is very clear that when you have free enterprise there, the economy will go up, see? That is true. But then, on the other side, there are people who said that, when you don't even have enough to eat every day, or your kids do not have any need with it, it is an abuse to talk politics with it. Anybody can talk politics with a starving man, you know? And that is why it reminds me of that, saying by Aristotle. Mm-hmm. That is to say, a man is a political animal only when his essential needs are satisfied. Which also implies that when his essential needs are not satisfied, he's just an animal. And so whether you are, promoting democracy or liberties, but if you talk to starving people, anybody can talk to a starving guy and make him do anything. And so I am also against that, you see. That is to say, you must have a certain minimum level of subsistence before you can talk politics to him and talk about going to elections and the ballots, you see. And the communist regimes, you know, with the Soviet Union, 70 years of history there, it is not prosperity at all. It hasn't been prosperity. You know, communism has not brought prosperity to its people. And the four communist countries now left in the world, you see, China, Vietnam, North Korea, and Cuba, you see. And in the case of China, it's a very special case because those guys are clever enough, you know, to accept, you know, the bankruptcy of communism, of the dictatorship of the proletariat, and so on and so forth, you see. And so I'm always trying to joke about it, whether, you know, the communist leaders, the Chinese leaders now, who claim to be socialists and communists, still, you know, but the country is very capitalist now, you see. So whether you call it a kind of a capitalistic socialism, or you call it a socialistic capitalism, mm-hmm. I mean, I am inclined to call it the socialistic capitalism, you know. And the Vietnamese are now moving in that direction, although they don't, you know, admit that they were wrong, mm-hmm. but they are moving in that direction. So the same thing with those who claim that you have to democratic liberties right away, that there is religious freedom and human rights and so on there, even if the Vietnamese people are still very poor and starving, mm-hmm. you know, almost. And on the other side, there are people who said that you have to bring up the economic level, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit more before you can talk about politics. Right. I said that I have the impression that they are the two sides of the same coin, in fact, you see. But if I have to make a choice, I would try and push up the economic a little bit faster, more, you know, and then play politics with them. Mm-hmm. So that was the dilemma of you know, the Vietnamese in the 60s and even 70s. Mm-hmm. See, whether you go all the way like Ho Chi Minh, trying to mobilize and use the nationalistic feelings, mm-hmm. you know, against the foreign presence, or as the nationalists would claim, the non-communist Vietnamese would claim that you have to respect human rights and democratic liberties, things which the majority of the Vietnamese people do not understand, really.
Yeah. So where do you come down? Where do you? What side do you go with?
I think that it's easier, you know, for practical reasons now, and that is also the position of the U.S. government now and the United Nations agencies and so on, that is to push up as fast as possible the economic development of Vietnam and give the people more than the $400 per head per year on GDP per capita, you know, income, so that things can be more meaningful to them. Mm-hmm. See? And then eventually try to infuse to them, you know, notions of what I call Western democracy, the ballots and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. They would be much interested in that. And since you know, the 1940s, the with Ho Chi Minh, and then for the last 30 years of you know, socialist regime there, I doubt very much that people, you know, understand anything about the ballot that they use. Mm-hmm. <You know? laughs> And the Communist Party always win 99% of the vote.
Right. Is it? Right. Right. A couple other questions about Camp A-15. You said there were some international organizations. Did they visit there?
Yes, and that was a very funny thing too, because once we have rebuilt the camp, mm-hmm. it became one of the most beautiful, it's number one camp in North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And then the Amnesty International came, and the International Red Cross, mm-hmm. and of course lots of governmental delegations from other countries, mainly from the communist bloc mm-hmm. countries, mm-hmm. Cuba and things like that. Mm-hmm. And on those days, those visits, all the inmates were taken to the fields, you know, except for a few, you know, chosen ones to stay there, to give the impression that there were inmates still in the prison. Mm-hmm. And then we were given straw mats, you know, to lie on and mm-hmm. sleep. So on those days of visits by those international organizations, new straw mats were laid down there, beautiful. And then the blankets also, new blankets, you know, folded there, mm-hmm. very nice. And those who were chosen to remain would do that kind of, you know, window dressing thing. Mm-hmm. And then there were also cans of condensed milk put, you know, here and there nearby to show that, you know, the inmates had all the things they need, you know, toothpaste and things like that.
It was a big show.
And that was a big show all the time. And those days, on those days, we had to bring our lunch with us early in the morning. So instead of waiting for noon time to be delivered the food we were giving, you know, at the time of departure for the day of labor, we brought those pieces of dough with us during the whole day. We would, you know, return very late in the afternoon before 5 p.m. to be locked up again.
Did you find your blankets and condensed milk and straw mats there?
Oh, no, when we returned, these things have disappeared. I mean, put back into the storeroom for the next visit.
That's incredible. Yeah. How did you guys feel about that?
Oh, and that was, you know, something that was accepted, you know. We were not surprised and, you know, nothing to say about it.
Right. Did you ever keep up with anybody after your release that you were imprisoned with?
Oh, yes, because there were a few who were my neighbors in Saigon.
Okay.
That finance minister who had his tests is swollen, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah. And he was just across the street from our home in Saigon. Mm-hmm. Eventually, he returned to France because he had a French wife, mm-hmm. Although divorced already. But the French wife was able to vouch for him and take him to France.
Okay.
And also, there was a case of a folk song singer, you know, that kind of Vietnamese opera, mm-hmm. you know, it's very Chinese, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of opera. And that case was really funny because he was in the My Tho area, just south of Saigon, about 50 miles. And he was in that classical theater group, you know, giving performances mm-hmm. in the My Tho city. And he got drunk on Saturday night. And the police picked him up completely drunk, you know, out. Mm-hmm. And the nearest thing where he was picked up was that camp where they kept the former Saigon people there, you right. know. That was right after the fall of Saigon. Mm-hmm. They didn't know where to put the poor guy completely drunk. They threw it into the camp. And that night, there were orders to pick up all the whole camp to take them to prison in North Vietnam. And the funny thing was that those people who came from North Vietnam to take delivery of the whole camp counted the inmates, and there was always one missing, according to the list, mm-hmm. you know, given to them from Hanoi. And so they didn't know what to do. They took the poor guy and put him in there with the other, you know, military and officers of the former Arvin and so on and so
oh
forth.
Oh, gosh.
So when he woke up the next morning, he found himself, you know, with those former Saigon soldiers and so on. So he yelled and he objected, and he was brought to Camp A-15 eventually with that. And he kept on insulting the regime and the communist leaders, and the more he did that, the longer they kept him. But he was eventually released with me.
Really?
Yeah, among the early, you know, releases.
So
and he went back to Saigon the same day with me, and he had relatives just also in the same area where I was, and so he stayed there and waiting for the chance to go back to his native city of Mithaw. But it was difficult because you were not allowed to move around. You were sent back to a place. I was sent back to my parents' home, and I had to remain there.
Mm-hmm.
You were not allowed even to cross the street and sleep in another home there.
Well,
you would be arrested.
We'll get to that in just in our next session. But this guy, he picked a bad night to get drunk, apparently.
Yes.
Wow.
And so he took
five years.
Yes.
Jeez. Wow.
There was, I don't know whether I mentioned to you, the case of a school teacher also in Gong Kong, who found himself in May 15 with us, you see. And his job as a school teacher, your elementary school in a village near Gong Kong, was to hoist the Saigon flag every Monday morning for the kids to salute at the beginning of the week. So after the fall of Saigon, he was, you know, in possession of that enormous Saigon flag. And he knew that it would be very bad if he were caught with that flag, you see. So he planned, had the intention to use that, cut it and make the shorts for his boys to wear, you know. But before he could do that, there was a search, you know, in the whole area, and he was found with that flag in his home. And so he was sent to Camp A-15 with us up there.
And all he did was raise the flag each Monday morning.
Yeah, and he said that he was going to cut it into pieces and make shorts for his kids, you know, but he didn't have time yet to do that.
How long did he stay in prison?
When I left, he was still there. I don't know.
So more than 5 years.
And I mentioned to you the case of that old guy. He was 72 when he was in A-15, came with us. Tam Hu, and he was completely illiterate. He was a horse cart driver all his life, and his son, the eldest son, went to the Viet Minh and the communist side. So after the fall of Saigon, the son returned. So he was very happy. He said, "I will kill a pig, you know, to celebrate." But during the meal, his son began to insult the American imperialists and the Saigon puppets. He said I couldn't stand, so I had to fight with him. And he was reported to use a big knife chasing his son, trying to kill him. And he was arrested and sent there. Completely illiterate, couldn't even read and write. 72 years old.
Did he survive?
I don't know. He was still there when I left.
You said a few times, or we talked about telling stories and talking about Western culture. Was there any talk of the United States and American culture?
I didn't know much of the United States. I haven't been there.
Right.
I was only one there 5 days in 1973.
Right.
So I talked more of the Europeans than the Americans.
Was there a lot of discussion about the war and what went wrong?
Everybody tried to avoid those things.
Really?
Yes.
Hmm.
Because we were not very convinced, you know, of the cause of the communist side.
Right.
But we did not, in those circumstances, we did not insist to say that we were right or wrongdoing. But there was a very funny incident. And again, with that finance minister, we had occasionally indoctrination lectures by big shots coming from Hanoi.
Right.
And it was done, in fact, by that vice minister of the security who came later on to talk with me several times.
Mm-hmm.
And he came, he was an old, from the old guard of Ho Chi Minh. He was in prison during the French colonial period and so on. So he was rather, you know, advanced in his age already. And he had much more experience with the French than with the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But he came to give a talk there one day at the camp.
Mm-hmm.
We were all there, thousands of us, in the courtyard. After the talk, he wanted to have comments and reactions from the inmates. He asked for volunteers. Nobody volunteered to say anything after his indoctrination talk. And the man, I mean, had the brilliant idea to call me up to give comments on his indoctrination talk. I was named and asked to go up to the rostrum and talk to the
inmates. How many people were there?
About 1,000.
About 1,000? Okay.
Yeah, so that was, I think it was the very first indoctrination, you know, talk that we had at the camp.
What did, how did you feel when you heard your name called to go up there?
Well, I didn't know what to say, you know, really, because I was not impressed at all by his talk. And so most of us were there, and it was almost like listening to the Hanoi radio or to reading the Nhân Dân newspaper, the same lines, and then continue to say that it was in the Vietnamese people rose up in the defense of democracy and freedom, nationalism, sovereignty, and against the American aggression, imperialist aggression. That was it. And so I was called, and I had to go up there, the rostrum, on the stage. And the only thing I found, you know, came to my mind to say, I said that, you know, the love for one's country, patriotism, is not a monopoly of anybody. That's what I said, very short and sweet.
That's it.
And I said that, no, I also said that I found myself here. You know, with all the people in this camp, I didn't see that any of them, as far as I could figure out that they were, you know, the assassins or, you know, bad guys, the cruel people. You know, we were trying to have, you know, the life, a normal, ordinary life, you know. And I said that, implying that we were no takers to the fatherland, you see, by saying that, you know, we are all, we only care for the well-being of the people and of our country. And I said that as far as I can understand it, you know, patriotism is not a monopoly of anybody or of any group. Oh, my God, it was a big silence. And then it was very tense. And the few of the cadres, the political guys, you know, were running in all directions, like that. So I went back and sat down on the soil, on the ground there.
South, outside or inside?
In the courtyard.
In the courtyard.
Yeah. Okay. And but the old man was very calm. Yeah. He tried to laugh it off. And then he called on another one to give comment. And that was the finance minister, that old, you know, schoolmate of mine in front. He was also very disturbed, of course, but the guy with his French education tried to pull a joke, you see, to calm down, you know, everybody. He then started to say, I don't know how to, you know, comment on the thing. But listening to the talk there, he said, he said he remember a story, you know, an Arab story. He said, he said that he learned the story that you have to beat your wife at least once a week. You know, you don't know why you beat her, but she knows.
He says this.
Yeah, he said that.
What did everyone do?
Nobody laughed. And he went back to it, sat down again.
That's all he said.
That's all he said.
So what happened next?
When it called off, the meeting ended. But it was a profound job.
Right, right.
It's like, you know, the commie is trying to beat
us.
Yes,
I know, I know. It's a lot of insinuation.
Yeah. And then it was really, you know, a big, big incident because of what I said. And then it was only late in the afternoon, that was during the morning session, that I was called to the office of Major Jung, who was there, and the Vice Minister of the Interior was there. So what I understood was that they called Hanoi, you know, report the incident. and someone in Hanoi gave them the instructions. So that vice minister, as soon as arrived, said, "Phong, don't worry, you know, about what happened this morning. Nothing at all. Don't worry. There's no problem at all." I said, "Thank you very much. I didn't mean anything bad." Mm-hmm. You see? And they said, "Okay, okay. So we would like you to know that you don't have to worry about it." I didn't believe it, but
you know. Right.
But nothing happened.
And that's all they said?
That's all.
Everything's okay. Yeah. Did anything ever happen to you?
Nothing at all.
Never mentioned again?
No.
Very interesting.
Yes. So that was incident. It was well known. And mm-hmm. the work, you know, was propagated in other camps too, because I got feedbacks from other people coming from other camps that they heard about this story.
So you became famous.
Yeah, I became famous for that
standing
incident.
Up and saying.
Yes. And many of them also said to me that because I used the word love in Vietnamese, you know, and they also, a few of them, try and counsel me, you know, not to talk too much about love anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
The inmates said this?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. They were afraid.
Right.
They were afraid.
Right.
Many of them were very afraid. And in fact, in the following weeks, I had the impression that, you know, a few of them tried to avoid me.
Really?
Yeah. They were not as friendly as they used to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you ever get called to make comments again?
No.
That was your only shot.
But there were other sessions, but right. I was not called to make comments.
They learned their lesson.
And they didn't ask anybody for comments any.
Oh, really?
In the following sessions, in the other sessions.
They realized it backfired.
Yeah, that was not a good idea. Even with the Arab story there. Probably went too.
Right.
So that was a bit of what happened in prison life during the
before we stop for today. What do you? You're able to laugh a lot about your prison life today.
Oh yes.
How can you do that? Why? How? Why are you able to do that?
Well, I think that probably because that was the way for me to overcome, you know, all kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I found myself in something, you know, too hard to bear, then I try to laugh it off, find the funny stories, mm-hmm. and I got the habit. I think I got it until now.
Mm-hmm. Not a bad habit.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, why don't we stop for today?
Okay, sure.
Okay, thank you very much,
thanks.
Sir. This is Richard Varone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Ambassador Nguyen Dung Phong. And today, March 14th, 2003, sir, it's been a little while since we talked, and we've been talking about your time in prison, and we had worked our way up until close to your release. I wanted to ask you a couple of basic questions about your prison experience. When you went in 1975, what did you take with you physically? What were your possessions? What did they allow you to have?
Well, we didn't take much with us because we didn't know where we were going. We were supposed to have only 30 days
right.
of education, and we were gathered at the Long Thanh orphanage.
Right.
And then after the 30 days, we were moved. I was moved with about 100 of the high-ranking mm-hmm. people of the former Saigon regime to mm-hmm. the Thuduc prison. Mm-hmm. We stayed there for a few weeks. Mm-hmm. And we were flown to North Vietnam, mm-hmm. Put in the number one re-education camp mm-hmm. in the camp called A-15 mm-hmm. in the Ha Tây district just outside of Hanoi. Mm-hmm. And in that camp, there were about a dozen buildings, but there was only one in concrete, brick one, and I was put in the brick one. But the others were just a kind of a mud straw type of building.
Mm-hmm.
which went down by one night by very strong winds,
mm-hmm.
and all the prisoners then rebuilt the whole camp,
mm-hmm.
in bricks. So we did not know, you see, that we were going to North Vietnam,
right?
And we didn't bring much. And we had just a few personal things, you know, very few clothes, and then no medicine, nothing at all.
You had two towels, you said?
I had, I had about six towels.
Six towels?
Yeah,
okay.
I was very keen on towels.
And toothbrush?
That helped me, yes.
Toothbrush, any soap, shampoo, any personal hygiene?
Oh, that went out, ran out months ago.
Right, right.
When
okay.
we moved to Hanoi.
Were you allowed to have any pens and paper, any writing?
Oh, yes, there was no rules, really.
Okay.
And we just brought along what we had.
Okay. When you left in 1980, what were you able to take with you? When you left, what did you have in your physical possession?
Out of prison?
Out of prison.
Oh, yes. Of course, we received a few packages
right.
in the meantime and had more clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had proper clothes to go home, shirts and trousers and so on. And of course, before we left, we gave a lot to those who remained because we knew that we would be home very soon, so we didn't take much with us. But we were able to retrieve our watches, our rings, our wallets, and personal belongings, which were kept, you know, while we were there, but returned to us when we were allowed to go home.
Was your money still in your wallet?
Not really money, because as you know, they changed the currency many times.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of money that we had in 75, which continued to be used, were the Saigon money.
Okay.
But by the time we were released, they were all, mm-hmm. Withdrawn from circulation, and we had the company's currency.
So you did have some currency, the new currency?
Yes, the family did send it for okay. a little bit.
Okay.
That we had enough to return home,
mm-hmm.
but many of us then at the railway station in Hanoi
mm-hmm.
Sold lots of things, watches on,
mm-hmm.
to have more cash and buy food and everything the first time
mm-hmm.
after many years,
mm-hmm.
and we were able to buy all kinds of things for the trip back home.
Do you remember? I'm visualizing right now the Hanoi train station. Downtown. Where did you, do you remember where you were on that street and where you were selling things?
Oh, yes.
You went back today, could you identify where
yes, because the guard who took us there, mm-hmm. we arrived about an hour before the train departure, and he swindled us also because we asked whether there was a possibility to buy the sleeping berth. You see? He said, sure, there was sleeping berth. So we gave him, I think, about $40 or something.
Mm-hmm.
The average monthly salary of the civil servant in Hanoi at that time was about $50. So the sleeping berth was about $40. And he said that he would go and get the tickets for it. And he disappeared completely.
Really? With everyone's money?
Yeah, with everyone's money. So we continued to be on our wooden benches there until 5 nights and 4 days. The old Amsterdam train, you know, it's mm-hmm. about 1,000 miles from Saigon mm-hmm. to Hanoi, Hanoi to Saigon. And at that time it took us 5 nights and 4 days on the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it ran about 20 miles an hour.
What did you do on the train ride home?
We just sat. Ate, you know, and looked at the landscape and so on,
mm-hmm.
and waited until we get home. And it was also kind of a poignant moment when we crossed the 17th parallel
mm-hmm.
again,
mm-hmm.
and we found ourselves in Da Nang,
mm-hmm.
and there was a very long stop there, so we were able to go and have a shower. Wait for the train and buy a few things
mm-hmm.
on the road. And we were also swindled by the merchants there, the little kids, of course, selling us, you know, rice cakes. And they offered us to taste, and it was very good, you know, little square things like this, as you may have seen in Vietnam. And so we bought lots of those rice cakes, glutinous rice, you see. But then on the way we discovered that as we opened those, it was in banana leaves, you know, wrapped in banana leaves, it was just clay inside.
Oh no!
But then we bought also some chicken, small chicken in the Quảng Nam, Quảng Tĩnh provinces. Very famous for their small chickens, they have just boiled, you know, steam. But that we saw well the chicken, so that's okay.
You saw what you were going to get, right?
But some fruits. But if we try, and if I try to understand and have an assessment of the reeducation, the so-called reeducation process, you know, there are of course all kinds of stories about those concentration camps. So first of all, you have difference between the military concentration camps and the civilian. The civilian would be under the Ministry of the Interior, but the military, the Department of Defense, also had the concentration camp for the former Saigon military. The very high ranking, the generals, the colonels, they were put in my camp, A-15, but secluded by a very high wall in the corner. But I suppose that from accounts given by the former Saigon military people who were put in those military concentration camps, it was very hard to do. Among the military, I suppose that they must have their own ways. But in the civilian camp, should I say, there were also a difference between the major camps like mine, or the one not very far from that, the Nam Ha camp, just also outside in the south of Hanoi, where only the high ranking former Saigon officials were kept there, and military too, colonels and so on. Then the treatment was much better than compared to, you know, far away provinces or far away places where the those concentration camps were really hard. And it is easily understood that, you know, the people running those camps in the far away and remote areas, they were much harder, you know, on the prisoners.
Why is that? Because they had less supervision and they could do what they wanted to?
Well, it's a matter of culture too. I mean, the people there, they didn't have much education, and there was still a resentment against all the bad things and the bombing from the U.S. And so on and so forth. And so probably the treatment was much harder there. And there were also attempts of escapes in those smaller camps than in the big camps. It was very difficult to envisage the possibility to escape from you know, the camps that for them, the one I was in. It was a very solid prison with high walls and so on.
Did you ever consider that, trying to escape?
Well, all of us thought of possibilities, but we knew very well that we did not have any chance to do that at all. Even if we managed to get out of the prison, we would not last very long, because you will see the people all around there, the villages, the hamlets would identify us right away. And that, you know, under communist regime, that much is much very much the population who would, you know, do those things. And I come to the understanding, the conclusion, that there is a difference, discrepancy between the principle and the practice, the theory and the practice of re-education of those camps. So we were not tried by any court. we were there. Legally, you would call in other countries, and that was also used by Saigon, a kind of an administrative detention, preventive detention, and things like that. But that, you know, usually should not last too long before you put the person to trial at the court. But I think that with the enormous mass of those people from the former Saigon regime, the Hanoi authorities must have a way to deal, neutralize those people at the beginning of those years after the so-called liberation. So they had to put those people considered you know, dangerous to them in those concentration camps. So the treatment may be different from one camp to another, but I think that the major concentration camps were much better than the small ones in the remote areas.
How would you define re-education?
Well, it's rehabilitation, re-education, imprisonment is the same thing, you see. But it has always been the contention of the people in that kind of field, re-education, rehabilitation, that you can make the man better, you know, by putting him in jail there and hope that you will change him. So that was the principle. But I'm sure that the Hanoi authorities, you know, could not believe in such a thing, that they saw some 200,000, you know, officials of the former Saigon regime could be brainwashed even, you know, to change their feelings and their thinking. So it was mainly a kind of preventive safety measures. So that after so many years, they would, you know, consolidate their administrative structure and the way that they can run the country, particularly in the south. But I don't think that they hope very much that they can change the mind of those former Saigon people. So that is the theory and the practice of it. And they try, of course, to in the major camps, to do whatever they could, you know, to show that they are a good government, that they treat the prisoners well, and it was true. Although by Saigon standards, it was terrible, very primitive living conditions, you know, even hygiene. We were not used to that kind of standard. But that was common in North Vietnam. And in many ways, we were much better treated than the ordinary people in the Ha Tây village. They didn't have toothpaste, they didn't have soap and all these things, sugar. We, every quarter, we had our share of ration from the Ministry of the Interior. See? I think we had 2 pounds of sugar for 3 months. It's for every 3 months, and we have the toothpaste, and we have soap, and all these things. And so, you couldn't say that you know it was lousy treatment compared to Saigon standards. They were, you know, very primitive, but compared to the ordinary people outside, we were, you know, privileged people. So that's one thing. And I think that they did not, in our case at Camp A-15, think that they could use violence or torture or anything of that kind that would go counter to their policy propaganda.
Because of who was there?
Because we were more than 1,000 people there, you see. And they always try to be polite. They talk courteously. They don't yell at us or they don't beat us. They didn't do that.
But they did this at other camps.
In other camps, that's for sure, you see. And there were cases that some of the people at our camp were taken to the Hoa Lo prison in Hanoi, the main prison, you know, where they called the Hilton in Hanoi, where the U.S. prisoners were kept there. And there was a case of a guy in my cell, he was the director of planning of our CIO, which is the equivalent of the CIA for Saigon, the Central Intelligence Office. He was the director of planning. So right at the beginning, you know, that guy very, you know, candidly proclaimed publicly that he knew lots of things, you see, because he was the intelligence business, mm-hmm. and he would do his utmost to help the communist governor, you know, with whatever knowledge that he had. Mm-hmm. So he was right. He was right away taken to the Wallah prison in Hanoi. Stayed there for months. Came back about a couple of times, mm-hmm. and then was sent to the Wallah prison again and disappeared completely.
What do you think happened to him?
And we learned later from the other prisoners in Wallah, they beat him up like mad to get information out. They couldn't believe him completely, although I don't know, the guy may be sincere when he said that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that was a lesson for us. That is to say, you should not believe what the guards told you. That is to say, the more you confess your crime, and the sooner you will go home.
Right.
And the more crimes that you confess, the more information they try to get out of you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also very funny because there was a low-ranking guy of the CIO in Saigon. He was responsible for the what we call the dead mail boxes.
The dead mailboxes?
Yeah, that's the Vietnamese expression.
Uh-huh.
That is designated area where you put the messages,
right.
receive your messages. Right. They're called the dead mailboxes.
The drops.
Yeah, the drops.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy, I think that he was kept until the very end. And we know that after even 10 years, there was no news that he was released at all. And it was also told that he had contacts with both sides, okay, through those dead mailboxes.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
And so the Hanoi authorities wanted to know who their traitors were, you know,
mm-hmm.
to furnish information to
right.
the Saigon intelligence
right.
Office and so on. And I was even told that he was kept there to serve, you know, other purposes too. That he, now and then that they wanted to put someone in jail, he just asked the guy to, you know, admit that he had contact with that chap.
And they could go arrest him?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it's not only the high-ranking people who mm-hmm. are kept there longest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Very, there was also very funny incidents. I told you, I think, that incident that went out the indoctrination meeting when
right.
he asked me
right.
to comment on it. But there was also a young chap. He was just the guard at the also the CIO, the Central Intelligence Office in Saigon. He was the security guard, very young, who was drafted, you know, he was 19 or 20, he was drafted, he was given the job to have to act as the security guard at the gate
mm-hmm.
of the CIO to open the gate for
mm-hmm.
the cars to go in and go out.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a very funny question to the instructor. He said at one of the indoctrination meetings, he said, why in 1954 with the Geneva Accords did not you get the South instead of the North? You see, I was born in the South. If you had chosen the South, I wouldn't be in jail today.
How did you answer?
There, we all laughed, but there was no answer, of course, to that question.
Right. That's funny.
But education was very well, you know, conceived and handled by the Hanoi authorities.
Very efficient.
Yeah. And you must admit, I mean, very objectively, it was exceptional how, you know, the war ended and how those Hanoi people dealt with the problem of those hundreds of thousands of former Saigon regime of officials. Not, I think, that they did that on purpose because of their good heart, you see, they would have eliminated us, you know, all if they could. That was their policy since the 1940s.
Right.
But I think the population would not understand it, and the international community would not understand it.
Right.
And in the end, I think they came slowly to realize that those Saigon people were not much of a threat anyway. They had 1 million troops and 500,000 U.S. troops there, who were not able, you know, to deal with them. So now 200,000 or 300,000 people, you know, of that former Saigon regime would be in position to, you know, do anything very drastic. So they took the chance, and they claimed in that case that they had a very humanitarian policy, and they did not mistreat it too much, although they jailed about 200,000 people, and many of them died in jail, of course. But I tried to find out at one time whether the percentage of death of the prison population was too abnormal or excessive. It was not too abnormal or excessive. We have to objectively accept and recognize that. And it was not thanks to them, because they did not have much capability to deal with the health care in those prisons, you see. And in fact, the health care was carried out by the Saigon doctors who were in jail there, mainly, you see. So with very little medicine, but at least we had a number of doctors, and in our camp we were very lucky to have several of them. And one of them was Dr. Ai, who was at that time of the fall of Saigon, the director of the Pasteur Institute. So he was a crack doctor,
right?
And he took care of us. And as I may have already mentioned to you, there was also another convict there, and he was jailed there for having killed his wife and her lover right in bed. He shot both of them, and he got 18 years. And when I was there, he was already in his 10 years or something. So he was a good doctor, because he was the director of a government hospital in Haiphong. So he was a good doctor. So they tried to do whatever they could to make it you know, acceptable for us to be in prison there. But the means were very limited, and so I think we had the best treatment that they could have given. But compared to the Saigon standards, those that treatment was really you know, to many people, inhumane and very primitive.
What about the torture and the things that went on?
We didn't
other
see
prisons?
It any at our camp.
But now, looking back at it, when you've heard story after story after story.
Yeah, probably in the smaller camps in the remote areas. And also, it would be very likely, as in the case of that the director of planning for the CIO, you know. Then you would be in the hands of the the professionals,
right?
And they have to go through all these things to extract as much information as they could from you. So that's you know, fair practice in that kind of business.
Okay. So are you saying that the torture had a purpose behind it, wherever it went on?
Yeah, interrogation.
Okay.
That is a process of interrogation. If you really believe that the, you know, the enemy had you know, valuable information, you would use any means to obtain that information.
There have been some South Vietnamese civilians who said, you know, they were basically tortured. Their experience in these so-called re-education camps were horrible, and they were jailed simply because they were a member of a leading family, or they were, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they're tortured, and they go through this, and then they're released. What do you have to say about
that?
Well,
to begin with, there was not much of a coherent administrative structure after the fall of Saigon to govern South Vietnam. And so, at the beginning, the so-called Viet Cong tried to take over, you know, because they were the people on the spot. But very rapidly, the Hanoi authorities move in. Within, I think, 3 months,
mm-hmm.
not more. And then they began to take over, you see, the administration of South Vietnam from the so-called Viet Cong people, who had no experience whatsoever to do those things.
Right.
But the Hanoi people, they probably be the best under a communist regime to administer anything. And so, you had, I'm sure, in the far away or remote provinces, incidents like that. And there were summary executions too, you see, probably because of the local sentiments, you know, after some years of repression or something, or
mm-hmm.
war. So you had personal revenge. There were lots of those cases.
Mm-hmm.
But that would not be, shall we say, like the Nazi, as a national policy to do those things and take people to the wall and exterminate them.
Mm-hmm.
So there was not. And in fact, the central government, you see, people tried to go to faraway provinces to put an end to those things because it would be very, very awkward
mm-hmm.
for them to let that situation prevail. But there were cases like that. But I would not say that it was, you know, a nationwide
mm-hmm.
thing. You had also, I'm sure, torture, also the exactions. But then it would be again on the local basis rather than a national policy. But there were cases like the Holland cases, I'm sure. See, I'm sure. So I would say that on the military, it was much harder, more violent than on the civilian.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
The military, they may be more prone to use violent methods than on the civilians. And to the Saigon people in general, I think the treatment was harsh because they're not used to that. But probably to the people in North Vietnam, it was normal. You see. But then, that kind of education, it was the most horrible thing was that the uncertainty. You were not told how long you would be there, how you would be treated.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, the mental pains would come from the inability to know what happened to my own parents or to my family.
Right.
So that was terrible.
Right.
When you are alone, when you are in jail, you think about yourself, you realize that it's just you, one person. But the rest of the family at home might be in even worse situations, see? And then we heard that the material living conditions outside were extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
They did not have much to eat and things like that. We did not have much to eat in the camp,
mm-hmm.
but we were sure that we would not be left to starve to death.
Right.
You see, so even if we lost weight, you know, very rapidly, but we didn't think that we would starve to death. In those camps.
What was your physical condition when you left?
When I went into the Long Tan orphanage, I was about 72 kilos.
Mm-hmm.
That would be nearly 160 pounds or something, 57 pounds. And about not even 2 years later, I topped to 43 kilos.
43.
Yeah, so that would be something like 95 pounds. I was able to weigh that because I happened to be in the kitchen one day, and they had the thing there to weigh the
scale.
Yeah, the scale to mm-hmm. weigh the flour and the, mm-hmm. you know, the cereals. I jumped on it to find out, and I found out I was 43. It was really skinny.
Did it shock you?
Not really. Because I accepted in advance that I would be, you know, diminished.
Mm-hmm. What about your oral hygiene, your teeth?
Oh yes, I lost my teeth, you know, one by one. And so when I was released, I was left with about six, which I managed to keep until the death of my parents in Saigon, living there about 10 years. I lost another three. And for the last 5 months that I arrived in Lubbock, I managed to lose the last three.
Really? Let's take a break. I need to change desks. Okay, we're continuing the interview. So let me ask you a couple of questions about the concentration camps, as you say, the re-education camps. Do you think there was an alternative to having these re-education camps that the Hanoi government could have implemented?
I don't really think so, because it was a threat to their regime. And particularly at the very beginning, when they were completely lost, what to do, you see, for the administration of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So you have there a big dilemma. So they decided that from the levels of service chief, that is just right below the directorate level, that is a director, then under the director you have the heads of the services. So the head of the services up, and on the military the lieutenants would have to go into those re-education camps. That was the only way for them to neutralize any adverse effect. And it was also true that right after the fall of Saigon, there were lots of people, you know, who were really worried, scared, you know, see, and would have done anything, you know, to try and fight back if they could.
Right.
And so I think that the Hanoi authorities had no other choice but to imprison those people. To my estimate, that was at least about 200,000 people who would be, you know, required to be imprisoned for rather long time.
Do you think that was a good, accurate number, or do you think it should have been much less than that? Or
well,
more?
It may be more, but at least I would say 200,000.
Okay.
According to the kind of structures we had with the Saigon government before. But then for the ordinary troops, for the NCOs and for those civil servants below head of service, they were supposed to have only 7 days of re-education. But on the spot, that is, they remain in their homes and they would report every day to the police or to the military unit there to listen to talks about indoctrination and so on and so forth. For the indoctrination lines, it was not too difficult for the Hanoi authorities to put out the arguments that they were for nationalism and the defense of independence and sovereignty and freedom and so on of the Vietnamese people against American aggression. So there was not much of an ordeal. And what happened was that they tried to keep the Saigon structures going. First of all, the utilities work without any disruption whatsoever. Water, electricity and so on continued, you know. And they were manned by the Saigon people, who knew how to do that, telephone and so on. But for the other fields of activities, even the Hanoi people were completely in the dark. They didn't know how to handle those things. So it was a complete stop. And the very first thing it was to have a survey or census of the people. Who was who and where, you know. And even the few weeks after the fall of Saigon, people continue to flee abroad. I mean, by all means,
right?
They went to Cambodia by road. They took the boat. But it must be recognized that the large majority of the population, little by little, came to realize that not very harsh action would be exercised on them. So they continue to go on with the new regime. And at the beginning, the stocks were still there, and so life was not too difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I was told that probably about 3 months later, problems began to pop up for the new administration.
Mm-hmm.
But it was at the very beginning, very much in the hands of the military. So even the Saigon Jiading area was put under a military rule of General Tan Van Tan, who was supposed to be from the NLF and a southerner. So he was much nearer to the so-called Saigonese.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the Hanoi people moved in, then the friction began.
Right.
It began first with the NLF.
Right.
And then the friction came slowly to the population. And so you have then really hard, you know, measures imposed on the population in South Vietnam. The population in North Vietnam, they were used to that, you know, since 1940s
mm-hmm.
and the 50s. But in the South, it began to be really difficult for them. And the difficulties were mainly economic to begin with. Not enough to eat, they had no work to do,
mm-hmm.
you see. And they had to reorganize the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they failed completely.
Why not allow, they tried to stop, the Hanoi government tried to stop people from leaving the country as much as possible over the years after, since after 75. Why not allow them just to leave, to escape at free will? To do what they wanted to do.
Well, first of course, it was political. They wouldn't accept that failure. Second, it's not that they really tried to prevent those people to go.
Mm-hmm.
Because deep down inside, if those people did not accept the new regime, they would be, you know, happy to let them go. They didn't try very hard, really very hard, to stop them. And so the boat people began, you see, the boat people began. And very soon it began in collusion with the local authorities. And so the boat people, the exodus, was to a large extent possible with the collusion of the local authorities. See, and especially there was some kind of understanding passed through those people at the local level,
mm-hmm.
you know, local level, I would say at the district and hamlet level,
mm-hmm.
That, for example, the Chinese, they would let them go, you know, quite freely. So the Chinese had the means to do it, and they were really worried, but they were not recognized by the United Nations, because Taiwan was not no longer the United Nations, and it was done by the Red Cross,
mm-hmm.
the National Red Cross, and they would go to Taiwan, you see, mm-hmm. instead of the other countries, like most of the Vietnamese.
Right.
And it cost a lot to arrange, you know, escape by boat, and so people put all their money in there in order to go.
If they weren't trying, as you said, to stop them so much, why was it so hard to get out of the country?
Well, because it was not officially permitted, and you have there lots of horseplay there, you know. The local police would take their dime in passing,
mm-hmm.
and then it was also a problem to gather enough people to get in a boat. And people were afraid to try and get someone to agree to join you, mm-hmm. To skate. Mm-hmm. So it was not something to do freely.
Mm-hmm.
But then, very soon afterwards, I would say by 1977-78, it was almost official. You see, that if you pay so much, so many taels of gold per person, then the local authority would even organize those trips for you.
Really?
And it was almost official
hmm.
by that time, 2 or 3 years later. And that was also by that time that the Hanoi authorities came to the conclusion that they better let those people go. And it was also by that time that they allowed the strangled foreigners who got caught by the fall of Saigon
right.
and retained there
right.
and considered dangerous or something.
Mm-hmm.
That was only by 1977-78 that the Hanoi authorities began to allow the repatriation of those foreigners, and including Elizabeth,
mm-hmm.
who was suspected to be a CIA agent, and for weeks she was called by the security people and spent the whole day with them under interrogation, and they began to take the position that she was not my real wife, because she does look very Vietnamese. She's a Hanoi girl, 100% Vietnamese, but mm-hmm. she's very tall, and she doesn't look very Oriental.
Mm-hmm.
And they claimed that she was planted there by the CIA to take the place of my real wife, who was still in Paris, because my real wife wouldn't be crazy enough to come back, 5 days before the fall of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
She was kept there for 3 years. Under the intervention of the French embassy and consulate, she was eventually repatriated back to France.
How much contact did you have with her while in prison?
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all?
Nothing at all.
Hmm.
But it was also a good thing, because, when I married her in Paris, who was alone in Paris at that time, my father didn't object very much, but I had a violent objection on the part of my mother.
Why?
Because she was a Northerner. She couldn't let my mother could accept that she has a daughter-in-law who would be a Hanoi girl.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
She would accept a foreign girl, French or American, easier than a Hanoi girl.
Really?
And that, in fact, Elizabeth's father was from the south. He emigrated to the north to begin a career there, and became one of the largest landowners in all Vietnam. He was very wealthy. And in the 1954-55 events, he was jailed by the communists, and then he died in jail.
Did your mother ever come around to accept?
And then, you see, during those 3 years, that had to stay in Saigon.
Right.
And my mother and her got over very well.
She stayed with your parents?
Yeah, the whole time. And they got over very well.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was a good thing.
Let me ask you a couple other questions about re-education before we move on. What if somebody listened to this tape, this interview, and thought that you were defending re-education, that it was not as bad as it has been made out to be?
I'm not defending re-education, but if you look through history books,
mm-hmm.
With a long war, bloody war, for 3 decades between the communist Vietnamese and the non-communist Vietnamese, I also wondered many times when I was in jail, what would we, the Saigon people, do if we won the war?
Right.
How you to treat those communist troops?
Right.
I'm not very sure that the Saigon people, would have reacted, less violently, because there were also lots of resentment on the part of those South Vietnamese against the communist troops too,
mm-hmm.
you see. And in fact, they were victims of more through, say, terrorist acts, mm-hmm. you know, by those North Vietnamese, again, the South Vietnamese. And then we had in South Vietnam, done against the population in North Vietnam, you see. And so the reception that we had from the North Vietnamese population was not as bad as I thought.
Okay.
So it's not a matter of defending your education. It's a matter of what would have happened, you know, the other way around to begin with. And then it's not defending your education, but I think that the North Vietnamese authorities had no other option to do that. Whether it's good or bad is another thing. But realistically, concretely, there was no other way for them, you know, if they were to preserve any kind of decency and dignity for their government.
Let me throw out something. During the American Civil War, after that, there was a military occupation of the former Confederate States of America by the United States Army. And there were military districts set up and military governors, etc. And this was about a 12-year process of reconstruction, as it has been called, was called and is called today. But there was not a lot of... some of the government officials were arrested and went through trials or were in prison. Some of the military leaders were as well. But overall, there wasn't a large majority of people or in the military who were imprisoned like this in these re-education camps. They were allowed to pretty much go home. Why the difference between the two?
Besides the obvious. First of all, you see, in that American Civil War, the defeated troops, you see, Chen Li, was no longer a threat to
right.
to the Union Army,
mm-hmm.
you see, but with what they believed to be 1 million Saigon troops, it was a real threat. And
even though they were defeated militarily,
but you must also remember that the weapons and arms, they could not really know, you know, what happened to those things,
mm-hmm.
and those Saigon troops. Could have, you know, set up, you know, areas of resistance,
mm-hmm.
Pockets of resistance, so it was a real threat. It was a real threat. And if you think in another aspect, you see, and here my uncles told me afterwards that by 1968. In beginning 1967, the relatively high-ranking members of the Vietnam Communist Party and in the North Vietnamese hierarchy, who were the Southerners,
mm-hmm.
who went up north in the 1940s to join the Viet Minh ranks with Ho Chi Minh,
mm-hmm.
at that time that was the case of my relatives,
mm-hmm.
on my father's side. They had many meetings with Ho Chi Minh,
mm-hmm.
who advised them, you know, to respect the setup in South Vietnam, economically, socially, everything, because Ho Chi Minh claimed that there were lots of assets, and the South Vietnamese, so-called South Vietnamese, were always considered as very, dynamic entrepreneurs and very active, efficient in doing business and in economic activities.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the idea put out even by Ho Chi Minh. But unfortunately, Lê Duẩn, who replaced Ho Chi Minh as Secretary General of the Vietnam Communist Party, maybe under the pressure of others, and also in the euphoria of the victory, you know, mm-hmm. historical, enormous victory against the almighty U.S. You see,
mm-hmm.
They did not respect that wish by Ho Chi Minh. That is to say, he had the idea of what Vietnam do systems, you know, like Hong Kong,
right,
and mainland China.
Right.
And I think he had always been very realistic, that man, you know. Of course he was a communist, and he was, you know, dedicated to have communist rule by all means.
Mm-hmm.
And he did all the dirty tricks possible,
mm-hmm,
you know, to grab power and to maintain the Vietnamese Communist Party there. But there again, it showed that, you know, they had the idea that the South Vietnamese could be an asset to them, you know. And so you don't take those guys out and shoot them, you see. And in fact, they should have, you know, try and use those assets, but mm-hmm, they failed completely.
Mm-hmm.
They failed completely. So that what I discovered after my release in 1980, it was chaotic.
If Ho Chi Minh would have lived, do you think it would have been different?
I think so. Because after him, there was no one who was, you know, able to say anything to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how you dealt mentally with the uncertainty and the imprisonment. You wrote in your book about hope, about dissecting this word and understanding what this was. Tell me about that.
Of course, you have to accept the sad reality that the Vietnamese, that the Vietnam Communist Party, since the 1940s,
mm-hmm,
did everything to grab power.
Mm-hmm.
They could not do that. Could have done that without the help of the Communist Bloc, you know,
right,
mainly the Soviet Union. So the history of Vietnam there, particularly from the beginning of the 1960s, you know, really closely related to the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the sad aspect of it, but that was the reality, you see. And deep down inside, I could not come to accept a conflict in ideology. For me, it was not a bloody conflict between communism and capitalism, because I never had the impression that capitalism was an ideology.
Right.
And it was a label put on the Vietnamese in the south of Vietnam that we belong to the capitalist world. I did not have the impression at that time that the majority of the so-called South Vietnamese were conscious that they were in the capitalist world or not. You see, it was rather a certain traditional way of life, Vietnamese way of life. And to me, communism would be contrary, you know, to that form and ways of life.
Okay.
But then Ho Chi Minh was clever enough to say that communism, you know, would enhance the nationalist feelings and nationalistic feelings and the customs and traditions of the Vietnamese people. I didn't believe that, you know. And for me it was international communism. Although at that time I did not dwell much in the differences of communism,
mm-hmm,
you know, from the Maoist kind of communism, even with Tito, mm-hmm, Yugoslavia,
mm-hmm,
you know. But it was a kind of solidarity, you know, in the international communism movement itself. And the thing was for me that, you know, if we had to accept any form of political regime,
mm-hmm,
communism was probably the worst thing that could happen to the Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm.
But if we had to accept that, you see, when I was in jail, I said, well, we we have to accept it. And, you know, live like the rest of, you know, the people who happen to be under communist rule too. I mean, the Czechs, the Germans, the Poles, and I don't know. All those people, mm-hmm. they continue to live on.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to accept that lot.
Okay. So, this is what you processed in prison?
Yeah. And then I had that, you know, coming back to that kind of ideological conflict, the mental, you know, exercise. I said that whatever you try to impose, you see, on the people, they always have ways to remain what they are. I mean, they come back to their traditional and ways of life mm-hmm. and their traditional values.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you cannot destroy those things. And I thought of Mao's communes, you see. Even if you try to do that, you cannot reduce, you see, the notion of the concept of family life,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all the basic values of, and it was also in my mind very clear that, you know, private possession, private property is inherent in human nature. You cannot eliminate that.
Mm-hmm.
You see, whatever you do, it will mm-hmm. come back.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I managed to have hope in that sense. That is to say, you cannot destroy, you know, the characteristics, inherent characteristics of human nature. And that was it. As I said, we will be able to come back to those values one day.
Do you think that's come true for you, for Vietnam?
In a way, you see, to a large extent, because they are the realities that you cannot destroy, that you cannot, you know, reduce, and you have to come back to it. And so, very concretely, now what is called the market economy, and that is the very return to your basics, you see. That is to say, whatever you may try to introduce, you will just come back to that.
Mm-hmm. What about the title, Hope and Vanquished Reality? Can you explain that?
Well, hope is that is the ability to continue when you see that there's no way out, but somehow you must try and continue, you see. So how can you have the energy and the motivation and the mentality to continue? You have to find, you know, things in order to convince yourself that it's still worth, you know, trying to continue. Vanquished realities came to my mind because we try to set up so many realities, you know, invent even realities.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, I was thinking of the outpost of the free world
right.
For South Vietnam.
Right.
And so, if you consider those things as realities, you know, they can be vanquished.
It's true. It's true. Tell me about the last of the train ride from Da Nang down to Saigon.
Yes, we arrived in the morning, early morning, after the fifth night of the train.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the, we were about eight, I think, to be released and returned to Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one who had his home near mine mm-hmm. in Saigon, the same district. And so the both of us, we agreed to share the cost of hiring a motorcycle pedicab.
Okay. Okay.
And so we were both on that. Yes. No, Seom is just a motorcycle with a guy behind.
Okay.
Yeah. But this one is the tricycle thing, but it has a motor.
Okay.
You see.
Ah,
so
yes.
It had a pedicab.
Yes.
Yeah. They go to the suburbs more than inside Saigon. And so at the Binh Trieu railway station, because they move the station outside of Saigon a bit to the suburb of Binh Trieu.
Your parents weren't there? No one was there to greet
nobody
you?
Nobody knew.
They didn't know you were coming?
Nobody knew.
Wow.
And so they meet up the informant, you see. And also we were totally usually about just a few days before the release. But in my case, it lasted more than 2 weeks because they could not find the convenient date to send us home. There was a shortage of guards because up to that time, there were about 3 or 4 releases before mine. And they were all accompanied, convoyed by a guard to Saigon. Mm-hmm. And that the guard would handed us to the authorities there.
Mm-hmm.
But that time of my release, we just went on our own. So we took that kind of motorized pedicab.
Real quick, how did it feel to be back in Saigon?
Oh,
you stepped off the train.
Exciting, really. It was exciting, but by the sheer idea that that I was back in my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, I was struck by the change in the appearances. You see, most of the houses there were very dirty, broken down, no maintenance or repair whatsoever for 5 years. And the people were, much, drab. the clothes, you
mm-hmm.
see,
mm-hmm.
and there was almost no car in the streets, just cycles,
mm-hmm.
lots of bicycles, but there were a few motorized, cycles there. And so we took that motorized pedicab and stopped just in front of my parents' home. And the chap who was with me, who was he? He was one of the low-ranking civil servants.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the other side of the street, in the small streets there. So we said goodbye and he went to his home. So it was about 10 o'clock when I was in front of the gate of the old house. It was really dirty too, the house, and was brought down. So I rang the bell. No one answered. No one appeared. I kept on ringing, looking back and forth and around. I didn't see anybody I knew, the neighbors and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I just stood there with my little sack back there, keep on ringing. I didn't even know that the bell was ringing or not, because couldn't hear anything from the gate,
mm-hmm.
from the bell ringing inside. And so I waited and waited. And then there was nowhere else for me to go.
Right.
I dare not go anywhere. And so I just stood there, hoping that someone would come in and out.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep on pushing. But then, at one time, I tried to look inside. The gate, the iron gate, was rather high, above my head, couldn't see anything, but there were cracks
mm-hmm.
at the joints. So I was able to look in there, just a small band.
Mm-hmm.
And then, about half an hour, I saw them a head popping back and forth at the corner of the house, with this garden
mm-hmm.
before reaching the house. And at the rear end, the corner of the house, I saw a head popping up and back and forth there, and I recognized it was my mother. So I yelled a lot. I said, "This is your son, Fong here," in Vietnamese. "It's Fong, your son, Fong, your son." And then she ran out. She was what, nearly 80 years old
mm-hmm.
at that time, and 78 or 79. And then very skinny. She was about 35 or 37 kilos.
Mm-hmm.
It was big, but it's skinny. That is about 70 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tears was running down. And she tried to open the small door, because there was a big iron gate, but there
mm-hmm.
was also a small door by the side there. She tried to open the small door. And I went in there, and we hugged for a long time. And she told me that my father had gone to the hairdresser, to the barber.
Mm-hmm.
And we went into the house. So that's how I arrived home.
How did it feel to be back in your home?
Wonderful. Really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And even without knowing how life would be, or how hard it was already, but to be back in your own home, to see my mother, much skinnier than before.
Mm-hmm. Well, so were you.
Yeah, and the house was also in a very sorry state,
mm-hmm.
With moss everywhere. There was a very nice garden that my father attended for years. It was very famous too, that garden. And it was completely wild. So my father was already in his late 80s at that time. He arrived about 10 minutes later.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really surprised to see me because nobody knew.
Right.
And my sister and brother-in-law took the kids out to the pagoda that day. So they left very early in the morning and wouldn't come back till the evening. So there were just the three of us there in the house that morning.
What did you talk about? What questions did they ask you?
Oh, they tried to tell me what happened to them,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to tell them what happened to me during mm-hmm. 5 years. It was very confusing,
right.
But I think the main and general impression was that we were so happy that we were, you know, together again,
mm-hmm.
and they were really, you know, horrified by my physical
right.
look, because I was really skinny and so. But I was happy to see them in you know, relatively good health, in spite of their age,
mm-hmm.
and. We keep on you know, telling stories, story after story,
mm-hmm.
Try to tell everything, to let you know, one another know what happened during those 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Did your mother cook for you?
Oh, yes.
What was the first thing you ate?
And since my sister and the kids and her husband was not there, mm-hmm. so my parents did not prepare much for themselves
mm-hmm.
for lunch, but with my return, that my mother insisted to cook lots of things,
mm-hmm.
and there was not much to cook, but she always tried to get the rice out,
mm-hmm.
some vegetables fried, and so on and so forth. There was no meat; it was very difficult to get any meat at all,
mm-hmm.
and. But then I noticed that they raised chicken and ducks and so on in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
So that what happened was that later in the afternoon, she killed a chicken.
Okay.
And tried to prepare kind of a feast for dinner
mm-hmm.
with the others coming back. But for lunch then, she cooked some additional rice and we all sat down and try to have lunch together,
mm-hmm.
but it was really good when I took my bag upstairs to my own room. All the clothes were there, the things were there,
mm-hmm.
still intact.
Everything.
Everything. And I just jumped on the bed. By the way, I didn't see a bed for 5 years.
Right.
So that was it. And took a shower
mm-hmm.
with soap and everything.
Mm-hmm. Not the pond anymore.
Didn't see a shower for 5 years.
Right.
So that was the return. And then had more discussion in the evening and Friday the night with my sister and all the others there.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was still in North. He would remain there 8 or 9 years.
In prison?
In prison, yes. Revocation.
Okay. 8 or 9 years after you got home, or total?
No, total.
Total. So he came 3 years, 4 years later?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
3 or 4 years later.
Okay.
Okay.
Would you like to, let's take a break.
All right.